LinkedIn News.
From the news team at LinkedIn, I'm Jesse Hempel, and this is Hello Monday. Happy New Year from all of us who make the show. It's going to be a really big year. There is so much change happening pretty immediately in the short term, like a presidential election ahead in the United States. AI is also going to be transformative this year. A lot of things that we have taken for granted are going to change. I mean, really, that is the only constant, right? Change. And this time of year, we often consider predictions about what's ahead. The reasoning here is that the more we can draw on what we know has happened to predict what we believe will happen, the better prepared we'll be. That's how we decide how much to save for retirement, or whether to take a new job, or to book a camping trip in California next August. I mean, the reasoning here is that it can't possibly rain next August in California because it doesn't rain on the West Coast in the summer, right? Here's the thing. We are not always great at prediction. Back yourself up 4 years. Would you have predicted a global pandemic in January of 2020? Or think about your own personal circumstances. Would you have predicted the life you have now? The job? The friends? Where you live? In the world, it's only becoming more unpredictable. It rained in California last summer, just saying. So this week, we're going to try to focus on getting smarter about how and when we make predictions. Our guest is Kit Yates. He lectures in math at the University of Bath in the UK. His book is called How to Expect the Unexpected. It's his goal to help us all get better at the science of prediction, and maybe even more importantly, to recognize when it's just not going to be all that useful. In our conversation today, we'll talk about psychics and the people who profess to be able to predict who will win the Super Bowl. He'll give us a reality check on randomness, and he'll help us sort out how to make better guesses and how to manage when we get new evidence that refutes what we thought we knew. Stay tuned.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
Kit begins by tackling the idea of control.
I think there's something deeply ingrained in us that we like to have control over what's going on. And part of that is about being able to predict what's going to happen in the future and to make plans and to have certainty about that. And actually, the world is not a certain place. There's randomness, there's uncertainty, there's probability that we have to contend with. And yeah, unfortunately, we can very rarely have that certainty. I think during the pandemic, we saw a rise of conspiracy theories, and part of that is people in a situation that they can't control wanting to reassert their own control over things. And we have this desire to have certainty in our lives, but actually we'd be much better off if we acknowledged and appreciated that there is uncertainty, that we can't predict necessarily what's exactly going to happen, and being able to make plans around that uncertainty.
In fact, there's maybe more uncertainty than we are willing to acknowledge, I would say. And for me, I think the pandemic really grounded me in that truth, right? The pandemic was a cultural moment for many people where we looked up and said, well, thought it was going to be this way. It turns out nothing, I think, seems to be going on.
Yeah, I mean, ironically for me, writing a book called How to Expect the Unexpected, the pandemic hit in the middle of me writing this book, and I ended up delivering it 2 years late because I basically stopped writing and started doing public communication of maths around the pandemic because I thought that this was a useful thing for me to do. And some of those stories have filtered into the book. But yeah, ironically, I did not expect that unexpected event, and it meant my book was 2 years late. So there you go.
Well, your book drew attention, of course, to the ways in which we make predictions that aren't terribly useful. We make a lot of bad predictions in life. But before we explore any of that, I actually want to just take a moment to get a sense of why predictions are important in the first place. What do predictions help us do?
At a personal level, they help us to plan for our own futures. You know, at a small scale, we look at the weather forecast to know whether we need to take a coat or an umbrella out with us. Or, you know, we need to plan for our financial situations. How much money can we save? How much do we need to spend? We need to do boring things like budgeting. And then at a societal level, we need to understand what's going to happen to, for example, the climate. We need to understand how climate change is going to impact on us. We need to know whether there's going to be stock market crashes. We need to understand about things at the risk of global disasters like the pandemic. So from the very mundane, everyday things that affect us in a small way to the huge scale factors which affect millions of people, billions of people, we need to be able to try to see what's going on in the future, even if it is shrouded in the mist of uncertainty.
Well, I think one thing that I take away from your book is that we need to evolve our predictions. We need to be willing to acknowledge new data and to see that data for what it is and change our mind around things that we had heretofore thought immutable.
Yeah, changing your mind is one of the most important things you can do, especially in the light of new data. I think it's very tempting for us to get stuck with certain opinions, and part of confirmation bias is only seeking out opinions which conform with the ideas that we already have, only seeking out data which supports our existing hypotheses. But that's not acknowledging uncertainty. That's assuming that we have one way of viewing the world and then trying to find evidence to back that up. And what we really need to do is to say, well, I might be quite confident about one particular view, but I'm going to acknowledge that there's some uncertainty. And if data comes in to support an alternative hypothesis, then I'm going to give more weight to that alternative hypothesis. We need to commit to acknowledging every time a new piece of information comes in that we add that to our understanding and reweight our hypotheses about what's actually going on. Because if we don't, if we just continue to ignore every new piece of information comes in, even if it's very small, then we never change our mind about things and we get stuck with the wrong views.
So talk to us about your perception of intuition.
The great thing about having a sort of mathematical view of the world is that you are allowed to have existing beliefs. You're allowed to, you know, believe, for example, that climate change is probably a real thing, and then to update that belief based on the data that comes in. So you're allowed to have intuitions about things, but you need to reinforce those with real data. And your intuition should change if the data changes. You really have to commit to that sort of viewpoint if you're going to get your predictions correct.
I was actually curious whether you would think intuition was a real thing or whether you would see it rather as something to acknowledge in order to make sure that it doesn't get in your way when you're making decisions.
So I think it depends what you mean by intuition, of course. You know, our intuitions are built up by our past experiences. To some degree, they reflect the way that we've lived our lives and the evidence that has come across our table so far, I suppose. So, you know, having intuition is not necessarily a bad idea, but that intuition is hopefully supported by some evidence. And the idea that you have a starting point from where you build your beliefs, that's not a problem at all. As long as you update that starting point as new evidence comes across your table, I think that's not a problem.
Right. So you start your book very early on by taking the reader on a journey with you to the least likely place that I would think that someone like you would go, frankly, to see a psychic.
Yeah.
Why did you start there?
Precisely because I've never been to see a psychic. I generally regard that stuff as sort of hocus pocus. But what I really wanted to see was, how can someone who isn't using scientific techniques, who isn't following many of the rules that we would use for prediction, how are they making claims? How are they convincing people that they know something about them or that they can predict something about the future without having access to these scientific tools? Because actually much of the history of prediction has been dominated by soothsayers and oracles and wise men and women. And actually, they didn't have access to the tools that we have nowadays. So psychics are as close as I could get to finding out how these people in the past were able to make predictions, which seemingly came true, or at least managed to convince people that they made true. So that's why I went.
It felt to me like perhaps the reason why you took us to see the psychic was to show us the ways in which we can easily be bamboozled by false predictions.
Yeah, absolutely. And this was something that really sort of came out of my trip, was an understanding of some of the ways in which we can make mistakes or some of the ways in which we can be bamboozled. So, for example, psychics might say to you, you know, sometimes you are really outgoing and you're the life and soul of the party, but other times you're quite introverted and you like to stay in and be on your own. And like, of course,
yeah, that's me.
Yeah, well, exactly. Right. Of course it is. Because everyone feels like that sometimes. She's used this, what's called a rainbow ruse, giving different aspects of a characteristic, two opposing aspects, which you identify with one or the other. And it's also called a Barnum statement, which is a very general statement which applies to most people. It's named after the showman Phineas Taylor Barnum, who the film The Greatest Showman was about. And he said of his circus, "We have something for everyone." And that's the idea of a Barnum statement. It says something to everyone.
Sure, that makes sense. And then, of course, over and over again, you surfaced the ways in which this woman relied on essentially statistics to provide things that felt deeply personal, like you referenced a man in your life whose name began with a J, to which I immediately thought, well, my son's name begins with J.
Right.
And you responded.
Well, exactly. So they say often a J or a G name they look out for, and then they sometimes even shotgun through John, James, Jim, Jack, Jane, whatever. But, you know, 20% of all men's names begin with a J or a G. And if you've got more than about six or seven male relatives, which probably most people do after you add up uncles and grandpas and dads and brothers and sons and grandsons and so on, then it's more likely than not that you have a relative whose name begins with a J or a G. But of course, the really weird thing about psychics saying, I'm getting a J name, you know, if they're in touch with the other side, why isn't the person on the other side giving them their full name? Why are they just giving them their initial? That's really weird. So, yeah, it seems like a bit of a ruse to me.
I will call out that as, like, you know, very much worth paying attention to. And yet, the thing that I find interesting is not whether psychics exist or not, but what we need so desperately that we look outside of ourselves for anybody who will give us a reflection of what we want to be true.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We have this desire to have our beliefs reinforced. It's a sort of confirmation bias. And I mean, I've been skeptical of the ability of psychics, but that doesn't mean to say that I don't think that they potentially can play an important role in providing comfort for people who've lost loved ones. But where it crosses the boundary is when they start to exploit people's insecurities or people's desires to speak to their loved ones in order to make money out of people, which is, at the end of the day, part of what the game is about. That side of it I find a little bit more sinister. So, yeah, I think we need to treat them with cautions.
We'll be right back with more from Kit Yates. Stick around.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days, all showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise. A promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. A promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
Hi, I'm Tomer Korn, LinkedIn's Chief Product Officer. On my podcast, Building One, we dive deep into what it takes to build great products. Recently, we had Zach Perret, the CEO of Plaid, and he shared about his struggles building a financial app for consumers and how he was able to turn it all around with a critical pivot. Take a listen.
I personally couldn't resonate as much with the consumer set that we were trying to reach. I just didn't have that level of empathy. When we made the shift to building a B2B product, though, I was building the product that I wanted. My co-founder and I were creating the product that we wanted ourselves, and we had so much empathy for what that product was.
Such a great insight.
You know, in that sense, we got lucky because we were creating a thing for ourselves. And then the people that we were talking to also had the same problems we did. They were fintech developers. We'd been a fintech developer. We'd been trying to build a fintech product for a year. And so we had such deep empathy. We had such a clear ability to...
If you want to hear more of Zach Perret's story and the lessons that follow, listen and subscribe to my podcast, Building One.
And we're back. I have to say that this conversation with Kit is a little challenging for me. I like to look at the world around me and see causal relationships. This happened, so of course that will happen. I like synchronicity. I believe in coincidences. And yet, in reading Kit's book and talking with him, I do also make room for the idea that way more things are random than I had even ever thought possible. And so I want to really understand here Kit's perspective on why embracing this randomness is so critical to navigating uncertainty. Once again, here's Kit Yates.
I think that if you don't see the process by which a result is generated, then you might think that that process happens the same way every time. But actually, if it's the result of a random process, then you need to know that. So, for example, there are betting scams where people are exploited. So someone is being smart and they're telling people to bet on a football game to win. So they write to 1,024 people and they give half those people the one result in the football game and the other half of the people the other result in the football game. And America is a great place to do this because you guys like to play until a game is won or lost. You don't have draws. So it's
true.
Like one team or the other. So this is good. And then after they've written and given that one result, they then take all the people they gave the correct result to and they keep playing with them and they forget about the other half they gave the wrong result to. And then they do the same thing. They split it half and half and give one side to one result to one side and one result to another. And they slowly go through these people. So they've got 512 and then 128 and so on. They go down the numbers until they've given someone five or six correct predictions in a row. Now, to that person, they're pretty convinced that this person knows how to predict sports results. They've done this six times in a row, and maybe there's eight people left at this point. And then they start to say, well, if you want the next correct prediction, you need to give me some money, and I'm going to predict it for you. And so they take, $10 off someone the first time, and then they get another correct prediction, and they've only got four people left, and then they take $100 and they ramp it up. So I think this idea that there are hidden probabilistic mechanisms going on underneath the hood that you can't see. If you can't see them, it means that you get a different impression than you would do if you could see the whole process. So I think it's really important to understand that there is uncertainty and randomness in lots of the processes that we experience every day.
I think one thing that really struck me was the degree to which there are things that are random, where part of the randomness is that we may perceive there to be patterns and incorrectly try to draw conclusions. And you reference, for example, the cases of childhood cancer. I wonder if you might talk to that.
Yeah, so we are not very good at spotting random patterns. We think that randomness means well spaced out. We don't think that randomness includes clustering. And so, as you mentioned, there is a group in Omaha of parents who noticed that when they overlaid the number of childhood cancer cases on a map, that actually some of them were clustered together. There were a few clusters across the city. And then they actually overlaid, they looked for environmental causes of these potential clusters, which I think were probably just caused by random clustering in random events. But actually they looked for these causes. And in one instance, they found that there was a group of power lines quite nearby. And so they suggested that these power lines were causing cancer, despite the fact that there was no scientific causative mechanism by which these power lines could cause cancer, despite the fact that there had been studies which suggested that power lines can't cause cancer. Because they'd seen this cluster of cases, which you would expect with random data, they had drawn a causative link between these power lines and the cancer cases. And yeah, so not being able to spot randomness can lead us to drawing the wrong conclusions, unfortunately.
I think that one thing that sort of raised for me is that people misuse data all the time, especially when they're trying to solve for something that they already believe, right?
Yeah, we do tend to have a tendency to search out evidence and data which agrees with what we already believe or a hypothesis that we already believe. Now, it's sort of fine in science. You have to have hypotheses and you have to go and try and get evidence which maybe supports those hypotheses. But actually, the way that the scientific method works is you don't look for evidence which supports the hypotheses. You try to disprove those hypotheses. So you actually try to build experiments which would what's called falsify your hypotheses. And you actually never prove a theory is true. You only fail to prove it false over and over again. And the more times you fail to prove it false, the more confident you are in that theory. But we, our brains don't really work like that in everyday life. So we find a hypothesis and we look for evidence to support that hypothesis. In looking for that sort of feedback loop, the more evidence we find, the more we believe it, the more evidence we find, this sort of confirmation bias, we're not really acting in a particularly scientific way, I would say.
Yeah. You referenced actually an example with a very good friend of mine, my friend Stephen Levy. But it was the Steely Dan example. The example of Stephen upon getting, I think it was maybe the original iPod, or maybe it was the Shuffle.
Shuffle, yeah.
He kept getting served up Steely Dan song. He loves Steely Dan. And he, you know, said, Steve Jobs, you're doing this. Like, you tech giant on the back end, you've got the data somewhere. This is all by design. And Steve Jobs said no. But Steve Jobs put engineers on the fact to make sure that that wasn't true, right?
Yeah, apparently, yeah. He asked the engineers, you know, is the algorithm genuinely randomly throwing up songs from music collections, or is there a mistake in the algorithm? I think that's what he asked them.
And it was genuinely random.
Yeah, the engineers got back to them and said it's genuinely random, and this is just what you would expect to happen. But I don't think Stephen was very happy with this, so he wrote an article in Newsweek, right? And then lots of people wrote in and said, yeah, this happened to me as well. And I think Stephen went back to Steve Jobs, and Steve Jobs ended up changing the algorithm on the shuffle to make sure that you couldn't have two songs by the same band play back to back. And as Steve Jobs put it, he said, you know, we're making the algorithm less random to make it feel more random, to better conform to our feelings of randomness. So, yeah, it's a lovely story.
So one area that we haven't really addressed so far is, by your measure, a somewhat new area of your field, this idea of game theory. And I'm curious how you would describe game theory to the uninitiated and how it can serve us.
So I think that one of the fundamental tenets underlying game theory is that people act rationally. And if we work on that assumption, then when we're trying to make predictions about how to interact with other people, we can boil down all sorts of interactions into relatively simple games. It sounds sort of perverse that we could boil down, you know, a war situation, who will strike first in a war, into a relatively simple two-player game. But actually, it's a really interesting and useful way to think about these situations. So we can build a what's called a payoff matrix, where we think about the costs of certain actions and the benefits of certain actions. And then based on those costs and benefits, we can predict what people will do in given situations.
And how likely are people to act rationally?
So I think almost everyone acts rationally, but it's about getting into other people's heads, right? So the only people that really don't act rationally are maybe like toddlers. So anyone with kids will probably know that, you know, two-year-olds are not particularly rational, and people with some psychological disorders, perhaps. But most other people act rationally, even people that we think of as irrational, like suicide bombers, which for most of us, we can't really understand how that's rational. But for suicide bombers, for example, they have been convinced that there is this afterlife where they're going to get huge rewards for killing themselves in this life. And actually, that means that for them, if they believe that to be true,
right,
that they're acting rationally by killing themselves, because the benefit from doing that, what we perceive as irrational action, is actually massively outweighing what maybe is for them quite a miserable life at the current time. So even things that we find difficult to understand and we don't think are rational can be viewed as rational, but you do have to get yourself inside someone else's head. So it is a game of psychology as much as it is a game of maths.
Yeah. So I'm curious, for somebody in your field, whether there is a role for empathy in the work and how you think about that.
I think people paint maths as this sort of cold, austere subject. But actually, we need to remember that maths is done by human beings. And again, people look at algorithms as ways to remove bias from their social media fields, for example. But we need to remember again that algorithms are written by humans, and they come with the biases that humans have. So I think there's an incredibly important role for understanding people's psychology. There are all sorts of maths of voting, maths of behavior, which are incredibly difficult to characterize, but really important, because one of the main flaws in the mathematical modeling during the pandemic, for example, was that we didn't account properly for people's behavior. We didn't account for the fact that people were changing their own behaviors based on what they were seeing. And this comes back to this idea of a sort of self-defeating prophecy. If you make a prediction which says that in the UK, 250,000 people are going to die if we don't do anything about this epidemic, and people change their behavior, and that prediction is a self-defeating prophecy. It makes itself not come true. And yeah, it's important to think about the potentially unintended consequences of our models and try to build that human behavioral aspect into our models.
I love thinking about the human role in math. I wonder if you have any parting thoughts for our listeners who may be thinking and rethinking their approach to making predictions.
They don't want to ruin things like coincidences for people because I think they're really fun. But one of the big messages in the book is that even extremely unlikely things, given enough opportunities, can and do happen. So, you know, it's very likely if you buy a single ticket for the lottery that you're going to win the lottery, right? But lots of people play the lottery. So most weeks, someone wins the lottery. And the same is true of coincidences. Like, coincidences strike us and they make us think that there must be a reason why we found this childhood book that we'd written our name in 30 years ago and we dug it up in a city 30 miles away. But actually, you know, it's usually just random chance and providence. It wasn't that someone planted the book there for us to find it. And I don't want to ruin coincidences because they're fun. But for me, the magic is not that they happen, because given enough opportunities, they can and they should do. But the magic is how you even recognize the coincidence in the first place. These coincidences are happening all the time. But one of the main messages is that we just shouldn't jump too quickly to conclusions when something unlikely happens, because unlikely things are happening all the time.
That was Kit Yates, senior lecturer and assistant professor of mathematics at the University of Bath. Kit's the author of How to Expect the Unexpected, The Science of Making Predictions, and The Art of Knowing When Not To. You can find it wherever books are sold. Now, there are so many things I am taking away from this conversation, but here are three. First, do not fear new evidence, even when, and maybe especially when, it runs counter to your current hypothesis. After this conversation, I feel a little hopeful that I might be able to get better at resisting confirmation bias and evaluate all the evidence put before me, even if it contradicts something that I really want to believe is true. Also, evaluating and accepting new evidence is an ongoing practice. It's not something we get to do just once. Second, sometimes perception matters more than whether or not something is sufficiently random. A case in point is the de-randomizing adjustment Steve Jobs made to the shuffle features on iPods to make it convincingly random. Third, coincidences happen all the time. Like just this morning, I thought of my mom, so I picked up the phone to call her, and there was a text message from my mom saying, "Hey, call me." These kinds of things are really fun to recognize. But the world itself is pretty random, and it serves us to get a little more comfortable with that idea. We're going to talk more about this at this week's office hours. I'll go live on the LinkedIn news page this Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern. Our contributor, Michaela Greer, is joining us this week. If you're not sure where to find us, you can always click the link in the newsletter, or you can drop us a line at hellomonday@linkedin.com, and we'll send it to you. And now we welcome Scott Olster, our big ideas editor, our books editor. Scott, what's your real title here at LinkedIn?
Oh, man, I don't know. I think they call me editor at large sometimes, but Scott, just call me Scott.
Scott's our reader friend. He joins us for the book segment on our show where we talk about books that he'd recommend, and he gives us the high points in case we don't quite have time to get to them. What have you got this week?
Well, lately I've been reading a book called Exit Interview, The Life and Death of My Ambitious Career. It's by an author named Christy Coulter. Christy has had a lot of different jobs, but this particular memoir deals with her decade plus at Amazon at a very specific moment in Amazon's lifespan. She started in 2006, right when it was really in this profound growth path.
Still kind of a bookstore.
Yeah, exactly. But with massive ambitions, right?
Yeah.
When you're at a company that's experienced this kind of growth, oh my God, it's a pressure cooker, and it can become your life. Yeah.
So tell us about Christy's career, and specifically why she ends the subtitle with the death of her career.
So Christy is, she's a hyperachiever, or the kind of person who needs to always feel like they're getting that A+.
I'm just saying, listener, right now, if you're listening and you're like, me too, I'm a hyperachiever, listen up.
The thing is, if you end up at a place like Amazon, they live off of taking those hyperachievers and making them feel like it's never enough, at least at Amazon at this moment.
Right.
And so she and the rest of her very similar colleagues are always struggling to be enough. And thankfully, Christy is this hilarious writer. But oh my God, some of the things that I'm reading about, just the culture of the place as she describes it.
Okay, give us a little bit. Come on.
Well, I mean, there's one of these exercises that's called the lifeboat exercise. Have you heard of this?
I am afraid that I think so.
Oh
keep
my
going.
God. It's like managers get into like a small room, like the one that we're in right now, and they just go around the room and talk about like who on their team, people that they manage, they would like throw off the lifeboat first. If they had to like,
Lord.
And I like, I mean, I knew that Amazon was a tough place, but oh my God.
Well, okay. So what you're saying is that this book is, it's silly. It's meant to be fun.
Yeah. And this is the thing that it reminded me of. So when I started my career, I worked at a law firm that was a real pressure cooker of a place. And the thing is, when you're in the moment, when you're having these high stress situations, you probably want to cry. But the thing is, when you remember those situations with colleagues, let's say, who are with you, you just start laughing. And she's great at channeling that energy.
Yeah. And not taking herself too seriously. But is there a larger message to this book for the discerning listener?
Yeah, there was a couple of things that came up in the book. I mean, one is just, it's the general message of being wary of cultures like that, of course. Christy had to go through several different reorganizations at Amazon, and they are just they can be very disorienting, right? You have to reinvent yourself. But she receives a bit of advice from a colleague during, I think, what was her first reorg at Amazon. And he said 90% of doing well at Amazon is really just knowing how the company works, being able to write a good document, write well, and being able to convince people from other teams to do what you think needs to be done. I think that's like 90% of so many jobs. It's like one of the best pieces, I think, of distilling like how to thrive. And for me, that message was we have so much more flexibility to make changes in what we do than we realize.
Yeah, so true. I listen to you say that and I'm like, oh, that's how you be successful here too.
Yeah, I think so.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Scott. We'll talk to you next time.
All right. Thanks so much.
Hello Monday is a production of LinkedIn News. Sarah Storm produces our show with help from Lolia Briggs. It's engineered and mixed by Asaf Gidron. Our theme music was composed just for us by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Michaela Greer predicts great things for the year ahead. Enrique Montalvo is our executive producer. Dave Pond is head of news production. Courtney Coop is head of original programming. Dan Roth is the editor-in-chief of LinkedIn. And I'm Jesse Hempel. We'll be back next Monday. Thanks for listening. I love that you call it maths, because we here in America are like, maths? What? What's he mean?
How many are there?
Exactly.
I will just point to the fact that we call it mathematics in long form. And so we're just shortening that. But
Okay. Equally,
I understand the math thing as well. And I think my first book is called The Math of Life and Death in the US. I'm cool with that. That's fine.
You can roll with that.